The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Welcome to episode 8 and hopefully the final chapter. Our scientist is now changing the gas inside the ship and he waits. It takes a surprisingly long time for a ship to lose all its air. In movies, if there's a little breach, everyone dies immediately. Or the muscular hero guy plugs the hole with his biceps or something. But in real life, air just doesn't move that fast. The emergency valve on the airlock is 4 centimeters across. Seems like a pretty big hole to have in your spaceship, right? It took 20 minutes for the ship's air pressure to drop to 10% of its original value, and it's dropping very slowly now. I think it's a logarithmic function. So in the middle of this emergency, I just have to stand here with my tank in hand. Okay, 10% is close enough. I say I close the airlock emergency valve to reseal the ship. Then I open the nitrogen tank. So now instead of listening to a hiss from the airlock, I listen to a hiss from the nitrogen tank. Not much difference there. Again, it's a bit of a wait, but not as long this time. Probably because the pressure inside that nitrogen tank was a lot higher than the pressure in the ship. Whatever. Point is, in short order, the ship is back to 0.33 atmospheres of pressure, but it's almost entirely nitrogen. Funny thing, I'd be perfectly comfortable if I took this EVA suit off. I'd breathe without any problems, right up until I died. There's nowhere near enough oxygen for me to survive. I want that nitrogen to permeate everything it can. I want it to get into every crevice, wherever Tomiba are lurking. I want them found and killed. Go forth, my Entomb minions, and cause destruction. I head down to the lab and check out the Boca. I left in such a hurry I forgot to seal the vat. Fortunately, astrophage is gunky stuff. Surface tension and inertia kept it inside. I close the lid and bring it up to the airlock. I jettison the whole thing. I probably could have saved the surviving astrophage in the vat. I could have bubbled nitrogen through the sludge to make sure it gets all the little Tomiba lurking inside. But why take the chance? I have over 2 million kilograms of astrophage. There's no point in risking the whole mission just to save a few hundred. I wait 3 hours. Then I flick the breakers back on. After a period of initial panic, the life support system gets the air back to normal thanks to the ship's copious oxygen reserves. I have to isolate every source of Tomiba on this ship, preferably before the life support system finishes pumping out the nitrogen. Why not do it before getting back to normal air? Because it'll be a lot easier and faster without wearing the EVA suit. I need my hands to do this, not my hands inside bulky gloves. I climb out of the Orlan and fly down to the lab, the nitrogen cylinder in hand. First up, the breeder farms. I put each of the 10 farms in large plastic bins. I install a little valve on each bin. Epoxy can do anything. And pump in nitrogen. If any of the farms have a leak, the nitrogen will get in and kill everything. Any farm that's behaving properly, keeping airtight, won't have any problems. The bins are airtight to begin with, but I seal them with duct tape anyway, and I deliberately overpressurize them by just a little bit. The sides and tops bulge out. Now, if any of the farms leak, it'll be visually apparent because the bulging will disappear. Next up, the beetles and their mini farms. John and Paul already have their mini farms installed. I put them in isolation bins just like I did with the breeder farms. I was working on Ringo when the poop hit the fan, so that mini farm and the one intended for George are still uninstalled. I put the pair together in another isolation bin. I tape everything to the walls. I don't want any of the bins to float around. They might bump into something sharp. The lab is a shambles. I was halfway through disassembling Ringo when I shut off the spin drives. Tools, beetle parts, and all manner of other junk floats around the room. I'll have to clean all that up without the aid of gravity before I can even take a break. Well, this sucks, I mumble. It's been 3 days since the great amoeba escape. I've taken no chances. I manually shut off all the fuel bays, completely segregating each one from the fuel system. Then one tank at a time, I opened it, collected an astrophage sample from the line, and checked it in the microscope for amoeba contamination. Thankfully, all 9 tanks passed the test. I brought the spin drives back online, and I'm cruising along at 1.5 Gs again. I cobbled together a amoeba alarm to alert me if this happens again. I should have done that in the first place, but hindsight is 20/20. It's a slide of astrophage, same as I used in the amoeba farms, with a light on one side and a light sensor on the other. The whole system is exposed to the open air of the lab. If amoeba get a hold of that astrophage, they'll eat it. The side will turn clear, and the light sensor will start beeping. So far, no beeping. The slide remains jet black. Now that things have calmed down and the problem is contained, I can start asking the million-dollar question, how did the amoeba get loose? I put my hands on my hips and stare at the quarantine zone. Which one of you did this, I say. None of it makes sense. The farms worked for months without any hint of a leak. The mini farms are hermetically sealed steel capsules. Maybe some rogue amoeba was lurking on the ship once since the last outbreak, back at Adrian. Somehow it didn't find many astrophage until just now. No, from our experiments, Rocky and I learned that amoeba can only last about a week without food before it starves to death. And they're not big on moderation. Either they wildly breed and consume all astrophage to be found, or they aren't present at all. One of these containers must be leaking. I can't just jettison everything. I need these amoeba to save Earth. So what do? I have to figure out which one is the problem. I check each farm as best I can. Since they're in bins, I can't operate any of the controls, but I don't need to. They're fully automated. It's a pretty simple system. Rocky tends to find elegant solutions to complex problems. The farm monitors the air temperature inside. If it drops below 96.415 degrees Celsius, it means there's no more astrophage because the amoeba ate it. So it pumps in a little more astrophage, simple as that. And the system keeps track of how often it has to feed them. From that, it makes a very rough approximation of the amoeba population inside. It adjusts the astrophage feed rate as needed to control that population, and of course has a readout to tell us the current state. I check each farm's readouts. Each one shows 96.415 degrees Celsius with a population estimate of 10 million amoeba, exactly what they're supposed to read. I say. The air pressure inside those farms is way lower than the nitrogen pressure surrounding them. If any of those farms had a leak, the nitrogen would get in and pretty soon the amoeba would all die. But they haven't, and it's been 3 days. The breeder farms aren't leaking. It must be the mini farms. But how the heck does a microbe work its way through half a centimeter of iridian steel? Rocky knows what he's doing, and he knows all about iridian steel. If it wasn't good for holding microbes in place, he'd know. They don't have amoeba on Arid, but they definitely have other microbes. This isn't new to them. All of this leads me to something I would normally consider impossible. Rocky made an engineering mistake. He never makes mistakes. Not when it comes to creating things. He's one of the most talented engineers on his entire planet. He couldn't have messed up. Could he? I need definitive proof. I make more astrophage test slides. They're super handy for amoeba detection and easy to make. I start with the bin containing the 2 mini farms, the ones intended for George and Ringo. They certainly seem sealed. They're just capsule-shaped pieces of metal. All sorts of stuff going on inside, but smooth iridian steel on the outside. I peel the duct tape off one corner of the box, pry up the lid, and throw an astrophage slide in, then reseal everything. Experiment number 1. Make sure I didn't accidentally breed up some super amoeba that can live in pure nitrogen. Another fun fact I've learned. Once amoeba get a hold of an astrophage slide, it'll be crystal clear in a couple of hours. So I wait a couple of hours, and the slide is still black. Okay, good. No super amoeba. I unseal the bin, open the lid, and let it air out for a minute. Then I reseal it. The nitrogen content in there will be nominal now. way less than Tomiba 82.5 needs to worry about. If there's a leak in those mini farms, the slide will tell the tale. 1 hour, no results. 2 hours, no results. I take a sample of the air inside the bin just to be sure. The nitrogen level is nearly zero, so that's not an issue. I seal it up again and give it another hour. Nothing. The mini farms aren't leaking. At least the ones intended for George and Ringo aren't. Maybe the leak was in one of the mini farms I've already installed. They're just glued to the outsides of John and Paul. They're not protected by the beetle's hull or anything. I repeat the Tomiba detection experiment with John and Paul's bins. I get the same result. No Tomiba at all. Okay, time for the ultimate test. I remove John, Paul, and the two uninstalled mini farms from quarantine. I set them on the lab table next to my Tomiba alarm. I'm pretty sure they're clean, but if they aren't, I want to know right away. I turn my attention to the even less likely culprits, the breeder farms. If Tomiba can't escape iridium steel, they definitely can't get through xenonite. 1 centimeter of that stuff can effortlessly hold in Rocky's 29 atmospheres of pressure. It's harder than diamonds and also, somehow, not brittle. But I need to be thorough. I repeat the astrophage slide test with all 10 of the breeder farm bins. There's no point in doing them one at a time. I pipeline the whole process. Now all 10 of the farms are in sealed bins full of normal air and have an astrophage slide inside. It's been a long day. It's a good time to take a break and sleep. I'll leave them overnight to see what happens. I bring bedding up from the dormitory to the lab. If my Tomiba detectory alarm goes off, I want to be darn sure it wakes me up. I'm too pooped to work up a louder solution, so I'll just bring my ears closer to the lab table and call it a night. I drift off to sleep. It feels wrong to sleep without someone watching. I wake up about 6 hours later. Coffee. But the nanny arms are downstairs in the dormitory, so of course I get no response. Oh, right. I sit up and stretch. I get up and shuffle over to the quarantine zone. Let's see how those Tomiba farm tests are going. I check the first farm astrophage's slide. It's completely clear. So I move on to the next. Wait, it's clear. I'm still not 100% awake. I wipe my eyes and take another look. It's still clear. Tomiba got to the slide. It got out of the breeder farm. I spin to the Tomiba alarm on the lab table. It's not beeping, but I run over to get a visual. The astrophage slide in it is still black. I take a deep breath and let it out. Okay, I say. I return to the quarantine zone and check the other farms. Every single one of them has a clear side. The farms are leaking. All of them are leaking. The mini farms are fine. They're sitting on the lab table right next to the Tomiba alarm. I rub the back of my neck. I've found the problem, but I don't understand it. Tomiba are getting out of the farms. But how? If there was a crack in the xenonite, the overpressure of nitrogen would have gotten inside and killed everything. All 10 farms have happy, healthy Tomiba populations, so what gives? I climb down to the dormitory and have breakfast. I stare at the xenonite wall that once housed Rocky's workshop. The wall is still there, but with a hole cut in it where I'd requested. I'm using the area mainly for storage. I chew on a breakfast burrito, trying to ignore the fact that I'm one meal closer to coma slurry. I stare at the hole. I imagine I'm a Tomiba. I'm millions of times larger than a nitrogen atom, but I can get through a hole and the nitrogen atom can't. How? And where did the hole come from? I'm starting to get a bad feeling. A suspicion, really. What if Tomiba can, for lack of better description, work their way around the molecules of xenonite? What if there's no hole at all? We tend to think of solid materials as magical barriers, but at the molecular scale, they're not. They're strands of molecules or lattices of atoms or both. When you get down to the teeny tiny realm, solid objects are more like thick jungles than brick walls. I can work my way through a jungle, no problem. I may have to climb over bushes, weave around trees, and duck under branches, but I can make it. Imagine 1,000 tennis ball launches at the edge of the jungle aimed in random directions. How deep into the jungle would the tennis balls get? Most of them won't get past the first few trees. Some may get lucky bounces and go a little deeper in. Fewer, still, may get multiple lucky bounces, but pretty soon Even the luckiest tennis ball runs out of energy. You'd be hard-pressed to find any tennis balls 50 feet into that jungle. Now, let's say it's a mile wide. I can make it to the other side, but there's just no chance a tennis ball can. That's the difference between Tomiba and nitrogen. The nitrogen is just moving in line and bouncing off stuff like a tennis ball. It's inert, but Tomiba is like me. It has stimulus response capabilities. It senses its environment and takes directed action based on the sensory input. We already know it can find astrophage and move toward it. It definitely has senses. But nitrogen atoms are ruled by entropy. They won't exert effort to do anything. I can walk uphill, but a tennis ball can roll so far before it rolls back down. That all seems really weird. How could Tomiba from the planet Adrian know how to carefully navigate its way through xenonite, a technological invention from the planet Arid? It does not make sense. Life forms don't evolve traits for no reason. Tomiba lives in the upper atmosphere. Why would it develop the ability to work its way through dense molecular structures? What evolutionary reason could there be to... I dropped my burrito. I know the answer. I don't want to admit it to myself, but I know the answer. I go back to the lab and perform a nerve-wracking experiment. The experiment itself isn't nerve-wracking. I'm just worried that the results will be what I expect. I still have Rocky's astro torch. It's the only thing on the ship that can get hot enough to disassociate xenonite. There's plenty of xenonite to be had throughout the ship, thanks to Rocky's tunnel system. I cut into the dormitory divider wall. I can only cut a little bit at a time. Then I have to wait for life support to cool things back down. The astro torch makes a lot of heat. In the end, I have four rough circles, each a couple of inches across. Yes, inches. When I'm stressed out, I revert to imperial units. It's hard to be an American, okay? I take them up to the lab and put together an experiment. I smear some astrophage on one of the circles and put another circle on top of it. Astrophage sandwich. Delicious. But only if you can get through the xenonite bread. I epoxy the two halves together. I make another identical sandwich, and then I make another two similar sandwiches. But instead of xenonite, I use ordinary plastic discs that I cut from some mill stock. Okay, four hermetically sealed astrophage samples, two with xenonite discs, two with plastic discs, all four of them sealed with epoxy. I get two clear, sealable containers and set them up on the lab table. I put a xenonite sandwich and a plastic sandwich in each container. In the sample cabinet, I have a few metal vials full of natural Tomiba, the original stuff from Adrian, not the Tomiba 82.5 version. I set the vial in one of the containers, open it up, and quickly seal the experiment. This is a very dangerous road to go down, but at least I know how to contain a Tomiba outbreak if it happens. As long as I have nitrogen, I'm okay. I go to breeder tank 1 in the quarantine zone. I use a syringe to get the Tomiba infected air from the bin, then immediately flood the bin with nitrogen. I tape over the hole made by the syringe. Back to the table, back to the lab table. I close up the other container and use the syringe to inject the Tomiba 82.5 in. Again, I seal that hole with tape. I rest my chin in my hands and peer into the two boxes. Okay, you sneaky little punks, let's see what you can do. It takes a couple of hours, but I finally see results. They're exactly what I expected and the opposite of what I'd hoped. I shake my head. Dang it. The xenonite-covered astrophage in the Tomiba 82.5 experiment is gone. The plastic-covered astrophage remains unchanged. Meanwhile, in the other experiment, both astrophage samples are unharmed. What that means? The control samples, the plastic discs, prove Tomiba can't get through epoxy or plastic. But the xenonite samples tell a different story. Tomiba 82.5 can work its way through xenonite, but natural Tomiba can't. I'm so stupid, I smack myself on the head. I thought I was oh so clever. All that time in the breeder tanks, generation after generation of Tomiba. I used evolution to my advantage, right? I made Tomiba with nitrogen resistance. I'm so awesome. Let me know when I pick up my Nobel Prize. Ugh. Yes, I made a strain of Tomiba that could survive nitrogen, but evolution doesn't care what I want, and it doesn't do just one thing at a time. I bred up a bunch of Tomiba that evolved to survive in xenonite breeder tanks. Sure, it has nitrogen resistance, but evolution has a sneaky way of working on a problem from every angle. So not only did they gain resistance to nitrogen, they figured out how to hide from the nitrogen by sneaking into the xenonite itself. Why wouldn't they? Xenonite is a complicated chain of proteins and chemicals I have no hope of understanding, but I guess Tomiba has a way to worm its way in. There's a nitrogen apocalypse going on in the breeder farm. If you can get into the xenonite walls deep enough that the nitrogen can't reach, you get to survive. Tomiba can't get through ordinary plastic. It can't get through epoxy resin. It can't get through glass. It can't get through metal. I'm not even sure it could get through a Ziploc bag. But thanks to me, Tomiba 82.5 can get through xenonite. I took a life form I knew nothing about and used technology I didn't understand to modify it. Of course there were unintended consequences. It was stupidly arrogant of me to assume I could predict everything. I take a deep breath and let it out. Okay, this isn't the end of the world. In fact, it's the opposite. This Tomiba can permeate xenonite. No problem. I'll store it in something else. It's still nitrogen resistant. It doesn't need xenonite to survive. I tested it thoroughly in my glass lab equipment back when we first isolated the strain. It'll still do its thing on Venus and Three World. Everything's fine. I glance back at the breeder farms. Yeah, fine. I'll make a big farm out of metal. It's not hard. I have a mill and all the raw materials I need. And God knows I have time to spare. I'll salvage the operational equipment from a farm Rocky made. Only the casing is xenonite. Everything else is metals and stuff. I don't need to reinvent the wheel. I just need to put it on a different car. Yeah, I reassure myself. Yeah, this is okay. I just need to make a box that can maintain a Venusian atmosphere. All of the hard stuff is already done, thanks to Rocky. Rocky. I feel a sudden surge of nausea. I have to sit on the floor and put my head between my legs. Rocky has the same strain of Tomiba. Aboard his ship, it's stored in xenonite farms like mine. All critical bulkheads of his ship, including the fuel tanks, are made of xenonite. There's nothing standing between his Tomiba and his fuel. Oh, God. I made the new Tomiba farm, sheet aluminum, and some basic milling on the CNC mill. It wasn't a problem. Rocky's ship is the problem. I've been watching his engine flare every day for the past month. Now it's gone. I float in the control room. The spin drives are off. Petrovascope is set to maximum sensitivity. There's some random Petrova wavelength light coming from Tau Ceti itself, as always. And even that's dim. The star, almost as bright as Earth's sun, now just looks like a fatter than usual dot in the night sky. But aside from that, nothing. I'm way too far away to detect the Tau Ceti Adrian Petrova line, and the blip A is nowhere to be seen. And I know right where it should be. Down to the million arc second. And from here, its engines should be lighting up my scope. I ran the numbers again and again, though I'd already proven my formulae correct by daily observations of his progress. Now there's nothing, no blip from blip A. He's derelict out there. His Tomiba escaped their enclosure and worked their way into his fuel bays. From there, they ate everything. Kilograms of astrophage gone in a matter of days. He's smart, so he surely has the fuel compartmentalized, but those compartments are made of xenonite, right? Yeah. 3 days. If the ship were damaged, he'd fix it. There's nothing Rocky can't fix, and he works fast. 5 arms whipping around, often doing unrelated things. He could be dealing with a massive Tomiba infection, but how long would that take? He has plenty of nitrogen. He can harvest as much as he wants from his ammonia atmosphere. Let's assume he did that as soon as he noticed the contagion. How long would it take him to get things back online? Not this long. Whatever may have happened, if the blip A could be fixed, he would have fixed it by now. The only explanation for it still being dead in space is that it has no fuel. He wasn't able to stop the Tomiba in time. I put my head in my hands. I can go home. I really can. I can return and spend the rest of my life a hero. Statues, parades, etc. And I'll be in a new world order where all energy problems are solved. Cheap, easy, renewable energy everywhere thanks to astrophage. I can track down Strat and tell her to shove it. But then Rocky dies. And more important, Rocky's people die. billions of them. I'm this close. I just need to survive 4 years. Yeah, it'll be eating nasty coma slurry, but I'll be alive. My annoying logical mind points out the other option. Launch the Beatles, all four of them, each with their own Tomiba mini farm and a USB stick full of data and findings. Earth scientists will take it from there. Then turn the Hail Mary around, find Rocky, and take him home to Arid. One problem. It means I die. I have enough food to survive the trip to Earth, or I have enough to survive the trip to Arid. But even if the Iridians refuel the Hail Mary right away, there won't be enough food for me to survive the trip back to Earth from Arid. I'll have only a few months of food left at that point. I can't grow anything. I don't have any viable seeds or living plant matter. I can't eat Iridian food, too many heavy metals and other major toxins. So that's what I'm left with. Option one, go home a hero, save all of humanity. Option two, go to Arid, save an alien species, and starve to death shortly after. I pull on my hair. I sob into my hands. It's cathartic and exhausting. All I see when I close my eyes is Rocky's dumb carapace and his little arms always fidgeting with something. It's been 6 weeks since I made my decision. It wasn't easy, but I'm sticking with it. I have the spin drives off for my daily ritual. I bring up the Petroviscope and look out into space. I see nothing at all. Sorry, Rocky, I say. Then I spot a tiny speck of Petrova light. I zoom in and search that area. A total of four little dots, barely visible or on the monitor. I know you'd love a beetle to take apart, but I couldn't spare one. The beetles with much smaller spin drives won't be visible for much longer, especially with them zooming off toward Earth and me headed in almost the opposite direction, toward the blip A. The astrophage coils in the mini farms will protect the Tomiba from radiation. And I did thorough tests to make sure both the farms and the life inside could handle the massive acceleration that beetles use. They'll be back at Earth in a couple of years from their point of view, about 13 years from Earth's time frame. I bring the spin drives back online and continue on course. Finding a spaceship somewhere just outside the Tau Ceti system is no small task. Imagine being given a rowboat, told to find a toothpick somewhere in the ocean. It's like that, but nowhere near as easy. I know his course, and I know he followed it, but I don't know when his engines cocked out. I only checked up on him once a day. Right now, I'm smack dab in the center of my best guess for his position, and I've matched my best guess on his velocity. But that's only the beginning. I have a heck of a search ahead of me. I wish I had tracked him more often, because I don't know the exact time his engines died. The margin of error on my guess is about 20 million kilometers. That's about 1/8 the distance between the Earth and the Sun. It's a distance so large, it takes a full light minute to traverse it. That's the best I can do with the information I have. Frankly, I'm lucky the error margin is so small. If the Tomiba had escaped a month later, it would have been exponentially worse. And all this is going on at the edge of the Tau Ceti system, barely the beginning of the trip. The distance between Tau Ceti and Earth is over 4,000 times the width of the entire Tau Ceti system. Space is big. It's so, so big. So yeah, I'm extremely lucky to have only 20 million kilometers to search. This far away from Tau Ceti, his ship won't be reflecting much Tau light. There's no chance I'd spot the blip A with my telescope. Side note, I'm going to die. Stop. I say, whatever I think about my impending death, I think about Rocky instead. He must have a sense of hopelessness right now. I'm coming, buddy. Wait, I'm sure he's sad, but he's also not one to mope for long. He'll be working on a solution. What would he do? His whole species is on the line, and he doesn't know I'm coming. He wouldn't just kill himself, right? He'd do everything and anything he could think of, even if it would have only a tiny percent chance of success. Okay, I'm Rocky. My ship is dead. Maybe I rescued some astrophage. The Tomiba can't have gotten all of it, right? So I have some. Can I make my own beetle? Something to send back to Arid? I shake my head. That would require a guidance system, computer stuff way beyond Iridian science. That's why they had a crew of 23 on a massive ship in the first place. Besides, it's been a month and a half. If he were going to build a little ship, he'd be done by now, and I would have seen its engine flare. Rocky moves fast. Okay, no beetle, but he's got energy, life support, food enough to last him a long, long time, original crew of 23, and it was always intended to be a round-trip voyage. Radio? Maybe he'll make a radio signal, something powerful enough to be heard on Arid, just a small chance of detection, but something. Iridians have a long lifespan. Waiting a decade or so for rescue wouldn't be that big a deal. Well, not on the life or death scale. If you asked me a few years ago, I'd say it's not possible to send a radio signal 10 light years. But this is Rocky we're talking about, and he might have some rescued astrophage to power whatever he creates. It doesn't have to contain information, it just needs to be noticed. But no, there's just no way. Some back-of-the-napkin math tells me that even with Earth's radio technology, which is better than Arid's, the strength of that signal at Arid would be way less than background noise. Rocky will know that too, so there's no point. I wish I had better radar. Mine is good for a few thousand kilometers. Obviously, that's nowhere near good enough. Rocky could probably whip something up if he were here. It's a little paradoxical, but I wish Rocky were here to help me save Rocky. Better radar, I mumble. Well, I have plenty of power. I have a radar system. Maybe I can work something out. But you can't just add power to the emitter and expect things to go well. I'll burn it out for sure. How can I turn astrophage energy into radio waves? I shoot up from my pilot seat. Duh. I have everything I need for the best radar ever. To heck with my built-in radar system, with its measly emitter and sensors. I have spin drives and a petroscope. I can throw 900 terawatts of IR light out the back of my ship and see if any of it bounces back with the petroscope, an instrument carefully designed to detect even the smallest amount of that exact frequency of light. I can't have the petroscope and engines on at the same time, but that's okay. Rocky is up to a light minute away. I work up a search grid. It's pretty simple. I'm smack dab in the middle of my guesstimate on Rocky's location, so I have to search all directions. Easy enough. I fire up the spin drives. I take manual control, which as usual requires me to say yes, 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 and override to a bunch of warning dialogues. I throw the throttle to full and turn hard to port with the yaw controls. The force shoves me back into the seat and to the side. This is the astronavigational equivalent of doing donuts in the 7-Eleven parking lot. I keep it tight. It takes me 30 seconds to do one full rotation. I'm roughly back where I started, probably a dozen kilometers off, but whatever. I cut the engines. Now I watch the petroscope. It's not omnidirectional, but it can cover a good 90-degree arc of space at a time. I slowly pan across space in the same direction I'd shine the engines, and at the same time, it's not perfect. I could get the timing wrong. If Rocky is very close or very far away, this won't work, but this is just my first try. I finish a full circle with the petroscope. Nothing. So I do another lap. Maybe Rocky is farther than I thought. The second lap turns up nothing. Well, I'm not done. Space is three-dimensional. I've only searched one flat slice of the area. I pitch the ship forward 5 degrees. I do the same search pattern again, but this time the plane of my search pattern is 5 degrees different from the last time. If I don't get a hit on this pass, I'll do another 5-degree tilt and try again, and so on until I get to 90 degrees, when I will have searched all directions. And if that doesn't work, I'll start over, but with a faster plan rate on the petroscope. I rub my hands together, take a sip of water, and get to work. A flash! I finally see a flash! Halfway through my Petrova plan of the 55-degree plane, a flash. I flail in surprise, which launches me out of the seat. I bounce around the zero-G control room and scramble back into position. It's been slow going up till now. I was as bored as a guy could be, but not anymore. Crud, where was it? Okay, relax. Calm down. Calm down. I put my finger on the screen where I saw the blip. I check the petroscope bearing, do some math on the screen, and work out the angle. It's 214 degrees yaw in my current plane, which is 55 degrees off the Tau Ceti Adrian orbital ecliptic. Gotcha. Time for a better reading. I strap on my now worn and banged up stopwatch. Zero-G has not been kind to the little guy, but it still works. I take the controls and angle the ship directly away from the contact. I start the stopwatch, thrust in a straight line for 10 seconds, turn, and shut down the engines. I'm moving something like 150 meters per second away from the contact, but that doesn't matter. I don't want to zero out the velocity I just added. I want the Prestoviscope. I stare at the screen with the stopwatch ticking away in my hand. Soon I see the blip again. 28 seconds. The spot of light remains for 10 seconds, then disappears. I can't guarantee it's the blip A, but whatever it is, it's definitely a reflection of my spin drives. And it's 14 light seconds away. 14 seconds to get there. 14 seconds to get back equals 28 seconds. That works out to about 4 million kilometers. No point in trying to work out this object's velocity by taking multiple readings. I don't have that kind of precision with my finger on the screen approach, but I have a heading. I can cover 4 million kilometers in 9.5 hours. I fist pump. Yes, I'm definitely going to die. I don't know why I said that. I guess, well, if I wasn't able to find Rocky, I'd set course for Earth. I'm surprised I put this much effort into it, actually. Whatever. I set course from where I saw the blip and fire up the engines. I don't even need to account for relativity on this one. Just high school physics. I'll accelerate half the way, then decelerate the other half. I spend the next 9 hours cleaning up. I'm going to have a guest again, I hope. Rocky will have to plug up all the holes he made in the Xenonite walls, but that shouldn't be a problem. That assumes the contact I got was the blip A and not just a random piece of debris in space. I try not to think about it. Keep hope alive and all that. I move all my junk out of the Xenonite areas. Once I'm done with that, I fidget a lot. I want to stop and do another sweep to confirm my heading, but I resist the urge. Just wait it out. I stare at the aluminum Tomiba farm in my lab and the slide of astrophage next to it in the Tomiba alarm. Everything is going just fine. Maybe I could. The timer beeps. I'm at the location. I scramble up the ladder to the control room and shut off the spin drives. I have the radar screen up before I even get in the chair. I do a full active ping in full power. Come on. Come on. Nothing. I settle into the seat and strap in. I thought something like this might happen. I'm a lot closer to the contact now, but still not in radar range. I just traveled 4 million kilometers. Radar range is less than a thousandth of that, so my precision isn't 99.9%. Big surprise. Time for another Prestoviscope sweep, but this time I don't have the luxury of a full light minute between me and the contact, wherever it is. If I'm, say, 100,000 kilometers away, I'll have less than a second before the light comes back to me, and I can't use the Prestoviscope with the spin drives on. So now what? I need to create a bunch of astrophage light without turning off the Prestoviscope. I look through the menu options and don't find anything. There's no way to have the scope on when the spin drives are running. It must be a physical interlock somewhere. Somewhere aboard this ship is a wire leading from the spin drive controls to the Prestoviscope. I could spend the rest of my life looking for that and have no success. However, the main engines aren't the only spin drives I have. The attitude adjustment engines are a little spin drive sticking out of the side of the Hail Mary. They're what let me yaw, pitch, and roll the ship. I wonder if the Prestoviscope cares about them. I keep the scope on and do a quick roll to the left. The ship rolls and the scope stays active. Gotta love those edge cases. Though I'm sure someone on the design team thought of this case. They'd probably decide the comparatively small output from the attitude drives wouldn't hurt the scope. And looking at the overall concepts, it makes sense. The engines and attitudes drives all point away from the ship and thus away from the Prestoviscope. The reason it shuts down when the main drives are on is because of reflected light off small amounts of cosmic dust. The reflected light from the far less powerful adjustment drives was deemed acceptable, but those adjustment drives are still putting out enough light to vaporize steel. Maybe they'll be big enough to light up the blip A. I aim the Prestoviscope parallel to the portside yaw thruster. In fact, I can see the thruster itself in the bottom of the visible light mode range image. I fire it up. There's definitely a visible glow in the Prestova spectrum. A general haze near the thruster, like turning on a flashlight in the fog. But after a few seconds, the haze dies down. It's still there, just not as prevalent. Probably dust and trace gases from the Hail Mary herself. Tiny particles of stuff drifting away from the ship. Once the thruster vaporized all the ones nearby, things calmed down. I keep the thruster on and let the ship rotate on its yaw axis as I watch the petroscope. Now I have a flashlight. The rotation rate of the ship increases faster and faster. I can't have that, so I activate the starboard side yaw thruster as well. The computer complains up a storm. There's no sensible reason to tell the ship to rotate clockwise and counterclockwise at the same time. I ignore the warnings. I do a full revolution and see nothing. Okay, nothing new. I do a 5-degree pitch adjustment and try again. On my 6th go-round at 25 degrees from the Adrian Ecliptic, I spot the contact. Still too far away to make out any detail, but it's a flash of light in response to my yaw thruster. I flick the thruster on and off a few times to gauge the response time. It's nearly instant. I'd say less than a quarter second. I'm within 75,000 kilometers. I point toward the contact and fire up the drives. This time I won't go barreling in willy-nilly. I'll stop every 20,000 kilometers or so and take another reading. I smile. It's working. Now I just have to hope I haven't been chasing an asteroid all day. With careful flying and repeated measurements, I finally have the object on radar. It's right there on the screen. Blip A. Oh, right, I say. I forgot. That's how it got its name. I'm 4,000 kilometers away, the very edge of radar range. I bring up the telescope view, but I can't see anything, even at the highest magnification. The telescope was made for finding celestial bodies hundreds or thousands of kilometers across, not a spaceship a few hundred meters long. I creep closer. The object's velocity with respect to Tau Ceti is about right for Rocky's ship, roughly the speed he would have gotten to around the time his engine died. I could take a bunch of readings and do math to work out his course, but I have an easier plan. I thrust for a few minutes here, a few minutes there, slowing down and speeding up until I match the object's velocity. It's still 4,000 kilometers away, but now the relative velocity to me is almost zero. Why do this? Because the Hail Mary is very good at telling me about its own course. I bring up the nav console and tell it to calculate my current orbit. After some stargazing and calculation, the computer tells me exactly what I wanted to hear. The Hail Mary is on a hyperbolic trajectory. That means I'm not in orbit at all. I'm on an escape vector, leaving Tau Ceti's gravity influence entirely. And that means the object I'm tracking is also on an escape vector. You know what objects in a solar system don't do? They don't escape the star's gravity. Anything going fast enough to escape did so billions of years ago. Whatever this is, it's no normal asteroid. Yes, 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 I say. I kick the spin drives on and head toward the contact. I'm coming, buddy. Hold tight. When I'm within 500 kilometers, I finally get some resolution on the object. All I see is a highly pixelated triangle. It's four times as long as it is wide. It's not much information, but it's enough. It's the Blip A. I know the profile well. I have a bag of Iliquina's vodka handy for just such an occasion. I take a sip from the zip straw. I cough and wheeze. Dang, she liked her liquor rough. Rocky's ship sits 50 meters off my starboard side. I came up really carefully. I don't want to cross an entire solar system just to accidentally vaporize him with my engines. I've matched velocities to within a few centimeters per second. It's been almost 3 months since we parted. From the outside, the Blip A looks the same as it always has, but something is definitely wrong. I've tried everything to communicate. Radio, flashes of spin drive light, nothing gets a response. I get a sinking feeling. What if Rocky's dead? He was all alone in there. What if all heck broke loose while he was in a sleep cycle? Iridians don't wake up until their bodies are ready. What if the life support system went offline while he was asleep and he just never woke up? What if he died of radiation sickness? All that astrophage that was protecting him from radiation turned into methane and amoeba. Iridians are very susceptible to radiation. It might have happened so fast, he didn't have a chance to react. I shake my head. No, he's Rocky. He's smart. He'd have backup plans. A separate life support system that he sleeps in, I bet. And he'd account for radiation. It killed his entire crew. But why no response? He can't see. He doesn't have windows. He'd have to actively look outside with the Blip A sensory equipment to know I'm there at all. Why would he do that? He thinks he's hopelessly derelict in space. Eva time. I climb into the Orlan for what seems like the millionth time and cycle through the airlock. I have a nice long tether anchored to the airlock interior itself. I look out into the vast nothingness before me. I can't see the blip A. Tau Ceti is too far away to light things up. I only know where the ship is because it blocks the background stars. I'm just out in space, and a big chunk of it has no pinpricks of light. There's no good way to do this. I'm just going to have to take a guess. I kick off the Hail Mary's hull as hard as I can, aiming for the blip bay. It's a big ship. I just have to hit any part of it. Nay, if I miss, the tether will bounce me back in the galaxy's first interstellar bungee jump. I float across space. The blackness ahead of me grows. More and more stars disappear until I see nothing. I don't even have a sense of movement. I know logically I must have the same velocity as when I kicked off my ship, but there's nothing to prove it. Then I spot a faint, blotchy, tan glow ahead. I'm finally close enough to the blip A that my helmet lights are illuminating part of it. It gets brighter and brighter. I can see the hull more clearly now. It's go time. I have just seconds to find something to grab onto. I know his hull has rails all over the place for that robot to get around. I'm hoping I'll be close enough to one to grab. I spot a dead rail ahead. I reach out. Slam! I hit the blip, much harder than an EVA suit should. I shouldn't have kicked off the Hail Mary with so much gusto. I scrabble at the hull, grabbing for anything. My plan to grab a rail failed miserably. I got a hand on one, but just couldn't keep a grip. I bounce and start drifting away. The tether gets tangled up behind and surround me. I'll be a long climb back to my ship for another try. Then I spot a weird jagged protuberance on the hull, a few meters away. An antenna, maybe? It's too far to reach with my hands, but maybe I can get it with the tether. I'm drifting away from the hull at a slow but steady rate, and I don't have a jet pack. It's now or never. I tie a quick slip knot in the tether and throw it at the antenna. And I'll be gosh darn, I nailed it. I just wrangled an alien spaceship. I pull the loop tight. For a second, I worry it might break the antenna off, but then I see blotchy tan texture. The antenna, if that's what it is made of xenonite. It's not going anywhere. I pull myself along the tether to the hull, this time with the antenna and tether to aid me. I manage to grab hold of a nearby robot rail. Phew, I say. I take a moment to catch my breath. Now to put Rocky's hearing to the test. I pull the biggest wrench I have from my tool belt. I rear back and smack the hull. Hard. I smack it over and over. Clank, clank, clank. I hear the sound through my own EVA suit. If he's alive in there, that'll get his attention. I push one end of the wrench against the hull and crouch down to bring my helmet in contact with the other end. I stretch my neck out in the helmet and push my chin against the faceplate. Rocky! I yell as loud as I can. I don't know if you can hear me, but I'm here, buddy. I'm on your hull. I wait a few seconds. I have my EVA suit radio on. Same frequency as always. Say something. Let me know you're okay. I turn up my radio volume. All I hear is static. Rocky! A crackle. My ears perk up. Rocky! Grace, question. Yeah, I've never been so happy to hear a few musical notes. Yeah, buddy, it's me. You are here? Question. His voice is so high-pitched I can barely understand him, but I understand Iridian pretty well now. Yes, I'm here. You are, he squeaks. He squeaks again. You are here. Yes. Set up the airlock tunnel. Warning, Tomiba 825 is, I know. It can get through xenonite. That's why I'm here. I knew you'd be in trouble. You saved me. Yes, I caught the Tomiba in time. I still have fuel. Set up the tunnel. I'm taking you to Arid. You save me and you save Arid, he squeaks. Set up the darn tunnel. Get back in your ship, unless you want to look at tunnel from outside. Oh, right. I wait eagerly by the airlock door, trying to watch the action play out through the little window. It's all happened before. Rocky attaching the airlock to airlock tunnel with the whole robot, but this time it was a little more challenging. I had to maneuver the Hail Mary into position because the blip A can't move at all. Still, we got it done. A final clank, then a hiss. I know that sound. I float into the airlock and check through the outer window. The tunnel is in place. He kept it all this time. Why not? It's an artifact from his species' first contact with alien life. I'd keep it, too. I turn the emergency relief valve. air from my ship fills my half of the tunnel. Once it equalizes, I throw open the door and fly in. Rocky waits for me on the other side. His clothes are a mess, covered in the all-too-familiar gunky tamiba residue, and there are burns all along one side of his jumpsuit, and two of his arms are in pretty bad shape. Looks like he had a pretty rough time. But his body language is sheer joy. He bounces from handhold to handhold. I am very, very, very happy, he says with a high pitch. I point to his bad arms. Are you hurt? I will heal. Attempted many things to stop Tomiga infestation. All failed. I succeeded, I say. My ship isn't made of xenonite. What happened? Question. I sigh. The Tomiba evolved to resist nitrogen, but it also evolved to get into xenonite to hide from nitrogen. The side effect is Tomiba 82.5 can work its way through xenonite over time. Amaze! Now what? Question. I still have 2 million kilograms of astrophage. Bring your stuff aboard. We're going to Arid. Happy, 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 he pauses. Need to make nitrogen wash. Make sure no Tomiba 82.5 get into Hail Mary. Yes, I have full faith in your abilities. Make a sterilizer. He shifts from one seat of bars to another. Those burned arms are hurting him, I can tell. What about Earth? Question. I sent the beetles with the mini farms. Tomiba 82.5 can't get through Iridian steel. Good, good, he says. I make sure my people take good care of you. They will make astrophage maybe for you to go home. Yeah, I say, about that. I'm not going home. The beetles will save Earth, but I won't ever see it again. His joyous bouncing stops. Why? Question. I don't have enough food. After I take you to Arid, I will die. You no can die. His voice gets low. I no let you die. We send you home. Arid will be grateful. You save everyone. We do everything to save you. There's nothing you can do, I say. There's no food. I have enough to last until we get to Arid and then a few months more. Even if your government gave me the astrophage to go home, I wouldn't survive the trip. Eat Arid food. We evolved from same life. We use same proteins, same chemicals, same sugars. Must work. No, I can't eat your food, remember? You say it's bad for you. We find out. I hold up my hands. It's not just bad for me, it will kill me. Your whole ecology uses heavy metals all over the place. Most of them are toxic to me. I'd die immediately. He trembles. No, you cannot die. No, you are friend. I float closer to the divider wall and talk softly. It's okay. I made my decision. This is the only way to save both of our worlds. He backs away. Then you go home. Go home now. I wait here. Arid maybe send another ship someday. That's ridiculous. Do you really want to risk the survival of your entire species on that guess? He's silent for a few moments and finally answers, no. Okay, get that ball thing you use as a spacesuit and come on over. Talk me through how to patch up the xenonite walls. Then you can move your stuff in. Wait, he says. You no can eat Arid life. You have no Earth life to eat. What about Adrian life? Question. I snort. Astrophage? I can't eat that. It's 96 degrees all the time. It would burn me alive. Plus, I doubt my digestive enzymes would even work on its weird cell membrane. Not astrophage. Tomiba. Eat Tomiba. I can't eat. I pause. What? Can I eat Tomiba? It's alive. It has DNA. It has mitochondria, the powerhouse of the cell. It stores energy as glucose. It does the Krebs cycle. It's not astrophage. It's not 96 degrees. It's just an amoeba from another planet. It won't have heavy metals like Arid and life evolved to have. They aren't even present in Adrian's atmosphere. I don't know. Maybe I can. He points to his ship. I have 22 million kilograms of amoeba in fuel base. How much you want? Question. I widen my eyes. It's the first time I felt genuine hope in a long time. Settled. He puts his claw against the divider. Fist my bump. I laugh and put my knuckles against the xenonite. Fist bump. It's just fist bump. Understand. I finish off the last bite of my me burger and gulp down the vitamin-enriched soda. I put my dishes in the sink and check the clock on my kitchen. Wow. It's that time already. I better hurry up. My first few years on Arid were touch and go. Tomiba kept me alive, but I became severely malnourished. The microbes gave me calories, but they weren't a balanced diet. Those were painful days. I have scurvy, beriberi, and a raft of other maladies. Was it worth it? I still don't know. I might never know. There's no way to communicate with Earth. It's 16 light years away. For all I know, the Beatles may have malfunctioned or missed their target. I don't even know if the climatologists like Leclerc were right in their models for what would happen. The Hail Mary might have been hopeless from the get-go. Earth might already be a frozen wasteland with billions of corpses. But I try to stay positive. What else have I got? For what it's worth, the Aridins are fantastic hosts. They don't have a government, per se, but all the important entities agreed to do whatever it takes to keep me alive. After all, I played a critical role in saving their planet, and even if I hadn't, I'm a living, breathing alien. Of course they're going to keep me alive. I'm of extreme scientific interest. I live in a big dome in the middle of one of their cities, though city isn't quite the right word. A better description might be cluster. I have grounds and everything. 30 Iridians outside the dome maintain my life support system, so I'm told. And my dome is very close to one of the larger science centers. Many of Arid's greatest minds collect there and thrum. That's sort of a song and discussion in one. But everyone talks at the same time, and it's not really conscious on their part. Somehow the thrum leads to conclusions and decisions. The thrum itself is much smarter than any Iridian in it. In a way, Iridians can become ad hoc neurons in a group of mind, but they come and go as they please. I'm particularly interesting, so pretty much every scientist on the planet came together to thrum up ways to keep me alive. I'm told it was the second largest science-oriented thrum ever executed. The largest, of course, was when they had to make a plan for dealing with astrophage. Thanks to my Earth scientific journals, they know all my nutritional needs and how to synthesize the various vitamins in labs. Once they solved that, smaller, less focused groups worked on making them taste better. There's more or less up to me, actually. Lots of taste tests. Glucose, common to both Iridian and human biomes, comes up a lot. The best thing, though, is they managed to clone my muscle tissue and grow it in labs. I can thank Earth science for that. They were nowhere near that technology when I first showed up, but that was 16 years ago. They're catching up quite well. Anyway, it means I can finally eat meat. Yes, that's right, I'm eating human meat, but it's my own meat, and I don't feel bad about it. Spend a decade eating nothing but odd-tasting, vaguely sweet vitamin shakes, and then see if you'll turn down a burger. I love me burgers. I eat one every day. I grab my cane and head out. I'm not a young man anymore. And the high gravity of Arid has only made my bones degenerate faster. I think I'm 53 years old now, but I'm not sure. I've done a lot of time-dilated travel. I can accurately say 71 years have gone by on Earth since I was born, for what it's worth. I leave through my front door and cross the grounds. There are no plants or anything. I'm the only thing on this planet that can survive my environment. But there are some very tasteful and aesthetically pleasing rocks. It's become a hobby of mine, making the ground as pretty as possible. The Iridians just see a bunch of rocks, but I see all the colors. They installed lights at the top of the dome that get brighter and dimmer on a 24-hour cycle. I explained that's critical to my mood, and they took my word for it, though I did have to explain to the species of interstellar travelers how to make light bulbs. I make my way along the gravel pathway to one of the many meeting rooms at the dome's wall. Iridians value face-to-carapace communication as much as humans do, and this is a good compromise. My side is within my bubble environment, and on the other side of the 1 centimeter clear xenonite is a room that's out in Arid's natural atmosphere. I hobble in. It's one of the smaller meeting rooms, really only suitable for a one-on-one conversation, but it's become our go-to spot for meeting up. Rocky waits for me on the Iridian side. Finally, I've been waking for 20 minutes. What took you so long? I can understand Iridian fluently now, of course, and Rocky is equally fluent in English comprehension. I'm old. Give me a break. It takes me a while to get ready in the morning. Oh, you had to eat, right? Rocky says, a tinge of disgust in his voice. You told me not to talk about that in polite company. I'm not polite company, my friend. I snicker. So what's up? He wiggles and jiggles. I've almost never seen him excited. I just heard from the astronomy hive. They have news. I hold my breath. Sol? Is it about Sol? Yes, he squeals. Your star has returned to full luminance. I gasp. Are you sure? Like 100% certainty? Yes. The data was analyzed by a thrum of AV astronomers. It checks out. I can't move. I can barely breathe. I start to tremble. It's over. We won. Simple as that. soul, Earth Sun, has returned to its pre-astrophage brightness. There's only one possible way that happens. Astrophage is gone, or at least reduced in population so much that it doesn't matter. We won. We did it. Rocky Cox's carapace. Hey, your face is leaking. I haven't seen that in a long-ass time. Remind me, does that mean you're happy or sad? Because it can mean either one, right? I'm happy, of course, I sob. Yeah, I thought so. Just checking. He holds a bald claw against the Xenonite. Is this a fist bump situation? I press my knuckles to the Xenonite as well. This is a monumentally epic fist bump situation.